Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum. I'm Melissa Griffin, columnist for the San Francisco Examiner and co-host of Necessary Conversation. We're here to talk about Occupy, what now, what next. Tonight we're joined by Diana Mikasa, Mayor Jean Kwan, Nadim Haidar, Iris Brown, and George Lakoff. Diana Mikasa is an outreach working group member for Occupy San Francisco. She was on the front lines of the initial Occupy SF movement, and she'll share her story. Jean Kwan is the mayor of Oakland and will offer her outlook on the movement, its effects on the city of Oakland, and the concerns and decisions that mayors with occupations are facing. Nadim Haidar is a nonviolent direct action trainer. He's been part of the Occupy movements across the nation and can provide an in-depth look at the actions and impacts of occupiers in Denver, Boulder, Santa Fe, Las Vegas, and Oakland. Iris Brown is one of the organizers of Occupy Oakland. She's been through the police crackdowns, the port marches, and the controversy behind the meaning and definition of nonviolence. Iris is also a member of Occupy Oakland's foreclosure committee. Professor George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist at the University of California, Berkeley. He recently wrote a piece about finding the political path to channel change. We're honored and excited to hear all their perspectives today, so let's get started. Okay, the first question is for Iris. Describe your history with Occupy and what it means to you. What is, in your opinion, the ideology of the movement?
So I was first attracted to Occupy, just like anybody else. I'd seen a couple of things on the news, and then I started looking at YouTube, because I don't usually pay attention to the news. I saw these videos of these worldwide movements, and then shortly after that, there was a general strike. I work in downtown Oakland, and so my job was closed that day anyway, and so I joined the march. And I was compelled by a lot of different things. I went down to the port shutdown. I didn't actually know what the original intention was of that port shutdown, but I later found out, and I believe that it aligned with my beliefs. And the experience that I had that night. The first thing that really compelled me to do was to get involved. So the next day I came to the encampment that was there, and I had several conversations, many stimulating conversations, and instantly plugged in a different ways to actually be involved and to help people. And I felt like I was doing something meaningful. That feeling grew more and more as I, you know, delved into different things. So that's how it started for me. As far as what Occupy is about, I think it's about empowerment, especially from that first experience, feeling empowered to do something. I know that there's a lot of talk and the conversations are good, but the most meaningful thing to me is the direct action that takes place. So.
Thank you. Diana, can you answer the same question?
Yeah. No,
playing on our iPhone.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just looking up a quote that I won't read right now. I wanted to say that, one, I am just a member of Occupy SF. I'm just here representing myself and speaking about my own experiences about Occupy SF. I also want to give a little shout out to the campers, because I myself am not a camper or a consistent camper, but there are tons of campers out here in the audience that have held down the encampment for the last 2 months, and they should definitely get a round of applause. As for how I got involved in the movement, I've been an activist here for about 3.5 years, doing immigrants' rights activism. And this past year, I think it's no surprise that we're Times Person of the Year. The revolts through the Arab Spring and actually Madison, and now through Europe, through Chile, and is now right here in the U.S., is one of the reasons why I decided to get involved. I was actually in Madison for one day during the Capitol occupation for 3 weeks. So when I heard about Occupy, I actually went down there. My first day, actually, was when the camp in front of 101 Market was raided. And when it was raided, it inspired me even more to be out here because I understood at what cost the activists that first started off the encampment, why they were there. For me, it's a fight about economic and social and environmental justice. And it's about actually changing the system that's based on the need for on human needs and not the need for profit.
Thank you. Mayor Kwan, can you describe the history of Occupy in Oakland from your perspective and if that's changed at all over time?
I think the first days of Occupy, it reminded me of Sproul Hall when I was a student at its best. I was 17 years old when I got to Berkeley and was a student on scholarship, the first member of my family to go to college, and I had never gotten a chance to meet as many politically diverse views, from the Young Republicans to SDS to Peter Kamel and the Socialist Workers' Party, I think it was. And in those days, the education Sproul Hall was probably as interesting as anything that was happening in my freshman classes. And I was also very energized, and I was very, very pleased. I think as the week went on, and when we did the march, I think MoveOn.org and Labor Movement March to City Hall was like the first time I began to get a little flickering of a little dissent, that they were forced to use a microphone separate from the camp, and then there was like sort of a split, and I was hearing the rhetoric about, oh, we didn't want those labor bosses to speak or those Democratic hacks or whatever, and I was like, okay, so is this going to be a 99% movement or not? But as mayor, there's a difference between being an activist and being political and then being mayor. Literally, I could see the camp from my office, and every day at 10, we'd get a report because I was under a lot of pressure by some of the gentlemen in the back from the media. Mayor, how long are you going to let the camp continue? And I said, pretty much it's a day-by-day decision. If it's a peaceful movement and that it's going on, we should, you know, we can tolerate that, and I think people are supportive of that. I think what began to happen at the 10 o'clock meetings is that during the second week, there was a change that when there was 911 calls, and there were 26 911 calls to the camp within the first 2 weeks, they seemed to be getting a little bit more violent, and that the 911 responders were not allowed into the camp. The one that really struck me is a woman had fallen out of a tree, 14 feet, and they didn't let the firefighters and the paramedics into the camp, and they dragged her to the edge, and that really concerned me. Then we started getting calls about sexual assaults and violence within the camp, and I think that happened in a lot of American cities because when you have an encampment that's not well organized, we had a lot of mentally ill people, we had some drug dealers at the end, we had a lot of homeless people, and without real organization, it's really hard to keep the camp safe. And what did it for me, and what convinced me that we probably had to close the camp, was the day that I woke up and read in the Tribune that the camp said that they couldn't control one of the mentally ill people in the camp, and they hit him over the head with a 2x4. And at the 10 o'clock meeting, the police chief said, and I said, did you hear about this? Were we called? And he said, no, but Highland and the morgue have called to say that Occupy people were there to see if they killed him. And I realized at that point that I had talked to people in the labor movement. I'm going to just finish this. I talked to people in the labor movement and people who were organized to say, are you staying overnight? And they said, no. And I said, I think if you don't do that, that we're not going to be able to maintain the camp. And so we gave the 5-day order to close the camp.
Okay. Thank you. I want to remind our audience members to please be respectful of the speakers. Professor Lakoff. From the beginning, Occupy has stood out as a very powerful brand. As a fellow Berkeley professor of yours, Jeff Nunberg, has declared Occupy the 2011 Word of the Year. Explain the concept of framing for us and how that's at play in the Occupy movement.
Framing is very ordinary. Every word is defined with respect to some sort of conceptual framework. like a panel. You know, we're on the panel, but there are certain things that aren't on the panel. There are panelists, audience, etc. That's part of a frame. Pineapples are not part of the frame. Now, the idea here is that what framing does is activate part of your brain. Every idea you have is physically there in brain circuitry. And in politics, everything you say has to do with morality. All politics is moral. Everybody says, do what I say because it's right, not because it's wrong, right? Or because it doesn't matter. And the question here is, what is Occupy about? You know, if you go and listen to folks there, there are lots and lots of things that I would agree with. Some I don't, but mostly things I would agree with. And things they're against are things that I would be against. But why? And there's a very simple reason. The moral basis that I see behind everything that Occupy stands for is the view that democracy in America had everything to do with citizens caring about each other and acting responsibly both for themselves and others. And therefore, you have a government that has to both protect and empower everyone equally and have a sense of the public that builds infrastructure, has health, and so on. The opposite view is that democracy is about the freedom to seek your own self-interest and not care about anybody else. And what that says is that the most moral people are the people who are successful at that, and therefore the 1% are the most successful at it, and therefore the most moral and shouldn't be taxed and so on. This is the very opposite of everything that Occupy believes and that I believe. And I think that that hasn't been said. There's a very simple way of answering what Occupy is about. It is, do you care about your fellow citizens, or are you willing to take responsibility for both yourself and them?
Thank you.
This question is for Nadim. You've traveled to a number of Occupy encampments. Tell us what you've observed in terms of language and meaning of the movement. Does it vary? And what are the similarities?
Well, okay, so I've been to Occupy Boulder, Occupy Denver, Occupy Santa Fe, Occupy Vegas, and today Occupy Oakland. To be honest, every camp is completely unique in its microculture, I would say. However, there is one common denominator, and that is the process, the dynamic that happens in the camp. Most of them, actually all of them, have been very transparent, participatory, directly responsive, based on consensus or near consensus. They differ with the numbers, so like some people will say 70%, some people will say 90% consensus, others will stick for 100% consensus. That these are the differences. It's a minor procedural issue. Most, however, agree on the basic fundamental values of complete freedom, complete equality, non-hierarchy, anti-authoritarian. And as such, they are pretty much all the same in those ways. They have their different obstacles and different challenges. For example, in Boulder, you were not allowed to camp, although they had tents. So you were allowed to nap in the day because it was considered napping. But once the sun set and you slept, that's camping, and you get a camping ticket. In Denver, the most problems we had were issues with police brutality. The police were extremely aggressive in Denver. In Santa Fe, very peaceful. The mayor was very good and allowed for the camps to survive, and hence the problems became different. Problems concerning more about how to deal with inner camp violence or things that happen between the campers themselves. And of course, so you see what I mean. They have different challenges and obstacles, but they all maintain the same fundamental moral, as George said, qualities.
Excellent. Okay, now we're going to talk a little bit about how the movement works internally, the mechanics of it. So to Diana, could you describe a little bit about how decisions are made and about the horizontal, people have called it, leadership structure that Nadim alluded to, but if you could talk more specifically about how it works here in San Francisco.
Yeah, no problem. So, one, I actually Want to take a minute to disagree with Gene Kwan, Mayor Gene Kwan here, about the organization of the camp, because I actually think both in Occupy Oakland and Occupy San Francisco, there's been extreme organization around the camp. there's been organization around how to deal with violence. Like, I think the other thing to be clear around is that we are not responsible for the ills of capitalism. We are not responsible for mental health issues. We are not responsible for drug abuses. That was, they are brought into the camp because they exist here right now. And the fact that the city refuses to deal with it, it makes it harder for us in the camps to deal with that as well. So I actually want to put that out there because in terms of organization, we are awesome. I mean, there's things we could work on, obviously, but there's, you know, there's been organization around camp logistics, the fact that we have a bike generator to run communications, the fact that we have kitchen organization where we fed, I believe the number was, what was it, like over 1,000 meals a day or something like that, like 1,500 meals a day, that's Occupy SF. So that's like, and all of the organizations happen in working groups. So there's a camp logistics working group, there's a kitchen working group, there's a security working group. At one point there was a counseling working group, like a mental health working group. There is also, outreach working group, direct action working group to like actually go out into the community and build the movement itself. The fact that we have marches every Saturday in San Francisco is a testament to our own organization. Also the fact that you know, we're able to come together and through 100% consensus process, able to make decisions. I won't deny that it's been difficult to get 100% consensus, but the beauty about consensus to me is the fact that like everyone can speak about where they stand, about the issues that they have at hand and then come together and figure out a way to move forward. And that's how we make decisions. There's no leaders in the movement. Everybody steps up, and I think that's how we've been able to build the movement in the past couple of months.
Thank you.
Could I do a quick response? So, first of all, I want to say that I think Lakoff and I and other people have said that a lot of the issues of equity and income and taxing the rich would not be on the agenda if it weren't for the movement. And so when we say we support, a lot of us say that we support the movement, that's very explicitly what I mean, that the whole Jerry Bounce initiative now to bring back the taxing the highest level as well as the sales tax to help the schools probably wouldn't have happened and been political possible without the movement. So, but I have to say that because I admire some of the things and this doesn't movement doesn't mean that all the things that other movements and other people do. So for instance, Oakland has was one of the few cities in the nation last year where our homeless numbers actually went down. We're known for our transitional housing, and particularly working with mentally ill and other people and getting them into single rooms and into jobs and whatever. So, while a lot of my friends worked on the homeless program there, they were pretty exhausted and knew that they couldn't substitute for some of the long-term work that we do with the homeless and the mentally ill in the city. So I don't think, to defend your work, that you have to put down our work.
Eddie?
I would like to respond. So first of all, I want to respond to your previous comment, Mayor Kwan, because you said, yeah, you know, we can tolerate the peaceful protest. Well, this is the thing about Occupy, is that we're no longer asking for your permission to tolerate or not tolerate anything. This is not a protest. Who are we protesting to in this? I mean, this is a reclamation. This is about occupying the commons, taking back what we originally have a right to have. As such, the Occupy camp is a social experiment in trying to engender new forms of social relations that do not depend on monetary exchange, that do not depend on the coercive authority of the state, but rather on the innate human decency, on moral values of freedom and equality. So this is no longer a matter of protesting, because by the very idea of a protest implies a hierarchy, implies that someone is powerful and someone's powerless. It's like the slave talking to his master. This is about reclamation, insurrection, and taking back what is rightfully ours.
I
I just want to point out that occupied was Oakland's been occupied by Oaklanders already. So the issue of in the plaza, if we want to talk about the economic impact and whatever, I particularly tried to get dialogue before the camp was moved for you to talk to the local merchants, to talk to the Chinatown restaurants, for instance, who said they lost 40% of their business during that time, or to talk to the other...
Everyone, please.
The Chinatown immigrant restaurants are not the rich, and if you can't define the 99% better than that, then that's one of the problems with the movement. I have several women initiative businesses that are around the plaza that we really help people to try to open their first businesses. They were being very hard hit. And so I understand it's hard to find a target, but if you don't look at that, you don't see that. It depends on who you measure. So.
Okay, everyone.
Can you guys let a speaker speak?
Thank everyone, you. Yes. No. Thank you. We need to get back on track here. Okay.
I'd be happy to set up a meeting with the Chinese Chamber.
You guys can all discuss this after the panel. Thank you. Mayor Kwan will be here. She's got to walk through that way. Okay. Everyone, we are moving on. Okay. George, how important is it that nonviolence be a part of Occupy? And how important is the direct democracy structure that Diana described to the movement, in your estimation, in terms of labeling and framing the movement itself?
First, I want to thank the people who are in the encampments. And the reason I want to thank them is that before September 17th, I heard so many people tell me in my presence, why aren't people not in the streets? Now they are. And because of you, the 99% versus 1% frame is out there. And it's being discussed for the first time seriously. So thank you. Now, the Occupy movement is a moral movement, as Nadeem was saying. And it has to do with various issues of democracy, having to do with caring about other people and about what you're taking over the commons, which you have a right to do. But in addition to that, there's something to be considered very seriously, which is what positive things are you doing besides what negative things are you doing? And by the way, that's a positive thing that you're doing, just in doing that. But there are other positive things to do, having to do with mortgages and having to do with banks. One can occupy banks, but not just stop them, but actually give people information about how to take their money out of certain banks and put them into credit unions and into banks that serve the community. I mean, that sort of information should be given out as a positive thing. There are many things one could do about schools, the fact that there are a great many charter schools that are owned by corporations and that are no better, in fact, often worse than public schools, and that they are destroying the public school system. There are various things the Occupy movement could do around that are positive in getting those messages out there. If you want a long list, I could probably go on for hours, and you probably could too. The point is to be positive, not to be negative, not to just stop, but to say what positive things you can do and why. What is the moral principle behind each positive thing? It has to do with caring about other people. It has to do with a sense of what the public gives to everybody, because the public, is what enables a vibrant private to happen. Nobody makes it on their own, in this country. You know, nobody who has run a corporation has put in their own sewers, built their own universities, etc. Nobody makes it on their own. And those who have made more money have used more of the public than anyone else, and that should be recognized. That idea needs to be out there every time someone talks, the idea of caring about each other, and the opposite idea, what is wrong with the greed market as opposed to the freeing market. It's not that you're going to get rid of businesses. People are in business. People run businesses that are good and that are productive in all kinds of ways. But the point here is not to have businesses that are there just for greed, but for serving the public. That's what they're there for, as well as to make a living. And that difference between a market that frees people to be productive as opposed to being destructive is very, very important. That message ought to be out there.
The next question is to Iris and then also to Nadim. How do you respond to the criticism of the horizontal leadership structure? People have said that without a clear 10-point plan or a president or without a hierarchy, that it's a problem. And they say that that's a weakness of the Occupy movement. How do you respond to those criticisms?
I think it's the strength of the Occupy movement. To have a leader in a movement is to align the 99% with a single idea. I think if we get too much into the semantics of demands, then we lose the sight of the common goal because we're too busy arguing about how we get there. You know, I think the Occupy movement is strong because it focuses on the end goal, the common goal, which is what George was just talking about, caring for one another in some way or form. We all have different issues and different things that bring us to the movement, and I think the more we disagree, the stronger we are.
I would like to not respond, but maybe add to Mr. George's comments. You addressed the grievances, the multiple grievances, and that's completely correct. One could go on with thousands of lists. This is one of the essential qualities of Occupy, is that there are not one demand, but 10,000 demands. As such, taken as a whole, all these grievances implies a fundamental transformation of the entire system, which is, this is where I'm going to get to next, when George says about taking care of one another and speaking about democracy in its true essence. I think also there's something being left out here completely, which is the issue of capitalism. And the issue of capitalism, by its very definition, I think, is something which does not allow people to manifest this new form of transformation of consciousness. So I would say is that when you mention businesses, businesses that do good, well, we have to remember issues like the priority of profit over everything else. Remember issues like the private ownership of the means of production. Remember issues that even in small businesses, there are relationships of exploitation between the employee and the employer. Now, I speak on behalf of myself, so I'm not speaking as the Occupy movement here when I say these opinions. But in essence, I am just simply building on George's comments in saying that these are the very critiques that the left has posed against capitalism in general. And they've been saying that capitalism does not allow for people to help each other out in such a way, that capitalism has inherently exploitative structures and must be dismantled in order to see a new system. As such, these grievances, these thousands of grievances, from the environment to healthcare to foreclosures, unemployed, war, I think have to be addressed through a critique, a radical critique, and also of capitalism, and also through providing living, concrete examples of what could be. And that's the whole point of the Occupy camp, is that we are showing people that this could be different. And it's, as such, a social experiment in trying to show people that we can have different forms of social relations that go beyond capitalism, that go beyond state authority, that don't have to depend on exploitation or hierarchy or coercive authority of anyone, but rather on the complete freedom and equal participation of every member of the community.
Thank you.
If I could go back to the issue of violence, I thought you were going to go into that issue a little bit deeper.
But thank you.
I think that violence and the nonviolent proclamation by the National Movement is absolutely critical. That's something that we didn't get in Oakland in the camp. When the motion went up to be nonviolent, they couldn't get 90% around that. And why I think if
everyone...
I'll finish this thought very quickly. If you're going to put yourself in the middle of somebody's city, in the space that's really sort of known as everybody's space, where every group comes, it's sort of our
space. Please let her finish.
And then not let other people use it. And then not take a proclamation, then not pass your own resolution to be nonviolent. It is one of the reasons the Occupy Oakland has sort of split into these two groups, Occupy Oakland and the 99%. And I think that that is an issue across the country that in other cities people are looking at. And so the question is, how do you move forward? How do we keep the ideas in terms of more economic equality? Because in Oakland, a very small group of violent people and were able to, on the day you had the general strike, which was fairly peaceful the entire day, and that I knew hundreds of people who worked to keep it peaceful. What the nation saw was the few seconds where a group of anarchists, a very small group, broke into a building, started setting fires, and that's all the nation saw of a very peaceful day, or of the windows at Whole Foods.
Everyone, you will have time to ask questions.
Just go with it. It's mic check.
As we only have, I believe, 10 or 15 minutes left, we're going to have to move forward to the moving forward part. So I'm going to ask the panelists to talk about the future of Occupy. And also, to because there are so many subjects we weren't able to get to, obviously we can go on forever and ever. There are so many subjects we weren't able to get to. Also, in addition to the questions that I'm going to ask, if any of our panelists have a topic that they wish to address, they can do so at this time as well when I call on them. Okay? And also, I'm sure there'll be great questions during the 15 minutes, so those will bring up other issues. So, again, unfortunately, we're just going to have to move forward. So think about what you would like to address. So let's begin a discussion about the future of Occupy. I want to read a little quote from, I think it's pronounced Calais Lassen from Adbusters, who is credited some people might disagree, but who was credited with sort of branding the Occupy movement. He was asked on NPR a few months ago, as the Occupy movement's urban encampments are rolled up by police, what do you think the protest movement should do now? This was his response. Obviously, it's winding down now. I think we should hibernate for the winter. We should be brainstorming with each other. We should network with each other, and we should come out swinging next spring. I think this occupying the parks phase of the movement is probably over. I think there will be other kinds of perhaps more surprise occupations, where next spring we come out and we occupy a bank for a day, or a corporate headquarters for an afternoon, or we go into an economics department and we take it over for a day or two. So to the panelists, the question is, do you agree with that statement? If you do or don't, please explain your answer. And that question is to Diana first.
One specifically, I do want to address the violence question that Jean Kwan put out there. The reality of it is that the encampments have been brutalized, that people, that hundreds of arrests in Occupy Oakland, in Occupy San Francisco, have occurred in the past few months. I was there when the tear gas happened that actually led to the vote on the general strike, and that was a scary, scary moment. I thought to myself, I'm out here peacefully protesting for a cause that I actually believe in, and why am I being attacked by the police? I'm tired of seeing my brothers and sisters in Occupy SF being bruised, brutally bruised by the cops for something that we're trying to do. We're just trying to change the world for a better place. That's all we're trying to do. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is the port shutdown, because I do want to diffuse any myths out there that the media is spreading about us being economic terrorists. The true economic terrorist is the 1%. They have the... The reason that this movement exists, or the term that's coined is we are the 99%, is because the 1% has 43% of the wealth. And we actually make that wealth. We're the ones responsible for their profit. So we shut down the ports, one, because we have been heavily repressed in this past month or so. But the second reason is because we're in solidarity with the ILWU workers that are being union busted in EGT, as well as the unorganized truckers in LA that were fired because they were wearing Teamster shirts. Like, I think we should make that clear, that the reason why we shut down the ports is because they're being attacked. So as the labor saying goes, an injury to one is an injury to all. So I did want to talk about, I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about the port shutdown, because Occupy Oakland did an amazing job. They went out, fired every single morning to the ports to make sure we had rank and filer support. Their rank and filer is part of the organizing as well to shut down the ports. So the people that say that we didn't have worker support on that day, that's all lies. The other thing that I wanted to say in terms of, like, where the movement is going, this question between violence and nonviolent tactics, we're going out there to defend foreclosures. Like, the reality of it is we might have to bust open a lock to make sure that a family or a grandmother or whoever can move into their homes and we can defend their home properly, because guess what? They were put into this mess by the banks and not us. This movement has many directions. We're going to be doing foreclosure actions. We are not going to be shutting down in the winter. We're actually going to have major actions on the 20th. We're going to be going to Sacramento in the first and the 5th, and we're going to continue organizing, because our end goal is to make this a better world that is based on human needs and not profit.
Question to Nadim.
Just to add to Diana before I address the Adbusters issue, speaking about economic violence, well, let me remind you about some facts, not controversial facts given by the UN, yeah? Let's remind you that 50% of the population of the world makes less than $2.50 a day. Let's remind you that the top 2% of the world's population control 40% of the wealth. That's economic violence, all right? So let's put that question aside. And this is why we're protesting in the first place. Concerning the Adbusters issue, I actually do agree. I've been to the past four camps, and let me tell you, it's really cold. It's really, really, really cold, okay? People are mostly concerned with keeping warm and keep getting food and shelter. Even you know, myself, I was not even able to read a book. You know, I wasn't even able to concentrate because of the cold I had to face. So essentially, the winter, in my opinion, is a matter of survival. Keep the camps there, survive, plan, organize, as he said, make good strategies and tactics that all of us agree upon, and use the spring as the boom. So yes, I agree.
Harris?
I'd like to address the fact that there are those that don't have the choice of going indoors. We are working on taking over foreclosed homes. We're working on targeting specific banks. And there are people that are out there still. There's an encampment in Occupy Oakland, right over there where the food is served, where people walk by every day on their way to their jobs in downtown Oakland. And there needs to be support there. There needs to be a visual component to Occupy, in my opinion. Again, I don't speak for Occupy Oakland. There needs to be a visual component because it reminds people that it's there. It continues the conversations that got most of us plugged in the first place. And if it's cold, go to REI or something. Get them some gloves, you know. Give them reinforcements. We need support. And as far as the violence thing, the economic violence thing, you know, I heard Kwan say in the back room before we came up here that she's upset about the fact that she had to spend $5 million clearing out the camp instead of, you know, on the resources that the city needs. Well, what's really ironic to me and what makes me laugh about that is the fact that we really could have used that $5 million. I mean, the homeless, I think, would have been much warmer if they wanted to stay outside, because a lot of them don't actually like the architectural structures of these homes that you're trying to put them in, or the hierarchy that exists there also. I mean, they're off the grid is the thing. And, you know, I say they're a step ahead of the rest of us, because they don't have to concede to the system. And so the economic violence that's imposed upon them every day, the overwatering of the tree and the economic violence that's imposed upon that old tree in the Frankagawa Plaza that now people are endearingly calling Kwan Lake. I mean, there's a lot of violence going on there. And I'm surprised that nobody up here has mentioned Scott Olson or Kayvon Sebegi, the man who was brutalized by at least four police and had a lacerated spleen. For 18 hours, he was held without medical attention and was only offered an ibuprofen through suppository.
So can I respond, since we've had three speakers and they've all talked to Port Oakland, so can I just do a quick response on the port? So first of all, I see Scott Olson, and I have to tell you, I was the first person who, as soon as I got back from Washington off the plane and heard it and saw the video and Scott, I immediately asked the video. I didn't know who he was then. I automatically asked for investigation. We are actually naming the private investigator. It's taken us a long time to find someone who I felt comfortable enough with, had enough distance in the police department to look at that. Nobody in Oakland is happy about what happened around the tear gas, around the mutual aid, and you were going to review those policies. I've been working with Judge Henderson to try to deal with the civil rights violations in Oakland for a long time that go back to the Black Panthers. This is a very tough thing for me to do as mayor, to deal with trying to make sure that we have public safety, but also make sure that the civil rights of the people in my community are recognized. On the economic impact, the Port of Oakland actually belongs to the people of Oakland. And this is a city-owned port. It is probably our best chance. And the city has made some really tough decisions. We could have put a shopping center there, but we decided that we needed to keep good-paying, blue-collar jobs in the city of Oakland because so many of our people need it. And you can laugh about that, but I gotta tell you, I work a lot with kids in West Oakland and East Oakland and the 100 blocks where there's the most violence in the city and where there's the highest unemployment and the highest dropout rates, and they really need those blue-collar industrial jobs, and it's one of the reasons why we've worked so hard to get investments to go after grants and to expand the working of the port. And yes, some longshoremen make $150,000 a day, but there are a lot of people in the hiring hall, and quite frankly, when you have shutdowns like this, ships get diverted, there's less work, there are real people who are really suffering, there are people even before this who were coming to us to talk about the truck issue, about the impact on the environment, and saying that they're about to lose their trucks because of the environmental things. And the cities work really hard to try to help them get their trucks retrofitted, to work with them, to make sure that there's a system of parking that doesn't, one, pollute the community, but let them get in and out and make their job. So economics, the $5 million, let me just end with this. The $5 million was not just for police. It was about $1.5 million of the vandalism around Frank Ogawa. And that's, you know, it is something that as the mayor of the city, I'm responsible for keeping safety and to try to keep my city from being hurt and vandalized.
What about the tree?
Okay. We are going to do, I have a question for George, but for people who want to ask questions, we're going to have a line starting back there where the microphones are. Remember, we only have 15 minutes, so we're not going to get to ask. Okay, never mind. Have a seat. We have Phil Donahue is going to walk around with a microphone. So be thinking about your questions, and we're going to start. Let me just have George answer a question before we get started. Okay, so George, while they're lining up and getting ready, you recently wrote a piece urging the movement to occupy elections. Could you talk a little bit about what you believe the future is politically?
I think it's important first to realize the effect of the Tea Party, which got Congress taken over by extreme right-wing Republicans who have done extraordinary things to destabilize the country and to do just awful things to a lot of people. And they are doing it at every level, not just in the House of Representatives, but in the states and communities all over. And they did it through taking over elections. And I think it is time, first of all, I want to distinguish between the folks who are out there in the encampments, in the streets, who have made all of this discussion possible, and those who are appreciative of those folk, of all of you. Because there are a lot of supporters out there. Recent polls show that 46% of Californians support the Occupy movement and over 50% support the ideals. There's a difference between the people who are supporters could occupy the Democratic Party. And there's a way to do that that is very important. Now, before I say that, many people who are out there in the encampments will say, well, the Democratic Party is also bought and sold, right? And there's a lot of truth to that. The question is, how do you change it? And I think you change it at least by having the supporters, if not necessarily those out in the streets, join Democratic clubs and insist on supporting those people who believe in the general moral principles behind this and the particular positions that are there. If you join Democratic clubs soon, you get to decide who gets to run, which is how the Tea Party took over. You can do that through volunteering. And the biggest thing about money in elections is that it buys people. But if you have a lot of volunteers who have moral commitments, they can do a lot that money would otherwise buy. So I suggest that those who support the movement start occupying elections in the following way. First of all, if you can run an encampment, you can run a campaign. Right? I mean, it's not easy to run an encampment. A campaign is probably easier. But the funding, the question is, do you have people? And most of the funding is for people. A certain amount is for, you know, for advertisements and so on. But a lot of it is just to hire people. If you have volunteers to do those jobs who insist that the party have the right moral principles and the right policies that follow from those principles, then you have power. Electoral power. And what can you do? You can not just support the people who you don't believe in, support the people only that you believe in. at all levels of government, at school boards, all the way up. And I think it's important because you can go out and campaign, you can knock on doors, talk to people, you can work in the office, you can do voter registration, you can do a zillion things that just take people doing work and committing themselves. And the people who are out there in the encampments are committing themselves to what they believe in, and they should. And they should continue to do that. But I think the supporters should be thinking very much about electoral power, because this is a very dangerous time. And it's no joke. Right now, the conservatives are not just taking over this country, they're taking over Europe to a large extent, taking over Hungary, they've taken over Canada. This is a world historical moment, and we should not lose the opportunity to occupy elections.
Okay, now we're going to move on to audience questions. I'm sorry, I know, Nadeem, I know you had a comment, but we're going to have to, maybe you can work it into an answer. So we're going to move on to audience questions. Caroline?
I'm going to lay out the rules of the game real quick. There are a ton of people who want to ask questions, and I want everyone to get the chance to do that. We do not have a lot of time to do that. I'm going to hold the microphone. If any person does not ask a question, if this person makes a statement, if the crowd answers the question, those people who are answering the question will be asked out. If this is not a question, I will take the mic down. This person will be asked out. We're going to start.
This question is for Gene Kwan. You described the December 12th march as economic violence. That's really a very dangerous tone to take, because you encourage real police violence, physical violence against peaceful protesters. My question is simply this. Do you think your daughter and husband were guilty of economic violence when they helped shut down the port on November 2nd?
Actually, Lailan was not in the demonstration hall. She was working all day. But my husband was one of 200 community monitors that we'd helped mobilize from labor and the community, because there's the Black Bloc group within a lot of demonstrations in the Bay Area whose main political tasks seem to be either to break windows in our city and vandalize buildings and or the fight with the cops. So, no, my husband, it is part of the Bay Area. You need to know the Bay Area a little bit, and demonstrators. And we had the problem in Meserly. They had it in the World Trade Organization here. It is a very organized group. And, you know, a lot of Oaklanders are not happy about that. And my husband and 100 labor monitors were part of that, to try to protect our buildings, to try to make sure that the wasn't violent, so that it would not actually affect the world perception of what was happening there. So my husband has his own politics, but we've both been political activists since we were teenagers. You can respect that or not.
Hi, my name's Tim. This question goes to George Lakoff. As a former student of yours at Berkeley, you've talked a lot about the power of words to include people and increase a message or accelerate it. I would like to see you address one of the big failings that I see in the Occupy movement, which is the ability to include more than 99%, like my parents who are immigrants, who live in Santa Cruz, who've spoken with the Occupy people in Santa Cruz, and they're scared with it because they're barely trying to make ends meet, and they see that as a risk to them to be able to actually make a living. So thus, they don't ally themselves with the Occupy movement because they see it as a threat to just being able to make ends meet. So can you address that kind of gap between the rest of the 99% outside of California or outside of the major cities and the middle of America who could get this message?
First of all, I'm sure that the folks in the Occupy movement don't all have the same opinions. I suspect that there's a lot of variety of opinions. And the Occupy movement is not just the folks in the encampment. There are people who are supporters all around. One of the questions that has been raised, and Nadeem raised it, is the question of capitalism. Now, there are very different forms of market arrangements. Among them, views of the market that say that markets should be there to help people as well as to allow people to make a living. And right now, we're not going to be transforming a lot of this country immediately by next week or next year or 5 years from now into something that doesn't have people running businesses trying to make a living. So So the question is, when people who are honest, who are actually trying to do something for their community while making a living, and are part of the 99%, and often the lower part of that 99%, they should be respected. And they, you know, they should be understood as being supporters. They probably do support the idea. And there's a very important idea that needs to be brought up. People will ask, what's wrong with people making millions of dollars? What's wrong with the people being in the 1%? Or the top 1/10 of 1%? And the answer to that is, they control scarce resources. Political resources, they have access. Educational resources, all sorts of, you know, land and so on. It's an unfair division of resources, which are really part of the public, part of what we all own, but and which we give to people so that they can have small businesses, so they can make a living. And I think very strongly we need to distinguish between greed capitalism, where we just are out for the money, and a form of markets that have to do with freeing people in their lives to make an honest living in a way that helps themselves and the community and never hurts anybody.
I also believe, thank you. I believe that Diana and Iris also would like to weigh in on that question.
Before we jump in there, I just want to invite the speakers, with the consideration of how many questions, to have short answers, short questions. Give it back to you.
Right. Okay, so Diana and Iris, if you guys could each address this, but in a timely fashion, that'd be great.
I'll be really quick. So I'm with Occupy SF Outreach, and basically our, like, we want to include as many of the 99% as possible. That's what's going to actually make this movement grow and actually move forward. So one of the things that we're planning on doing is community forums in the different neighborhoods. And as an immigrants' rights activist, I actually planned a month ago an immigrants' rights march with Occupy SF, with the Day Laborers Program, and the Women's Collective of La Raza Central Legal. We've had human rights marches. We have an anti-war march coming up on Saturday. We're trying to include as many of the 99% as possible. And right now, the marches are the few ways that we're going to do it, but we're going to go back into communities and hear what they want, where they want the Occupy movement to go.
Okay, I just wanted to address what you were saying about the elections. I know that that's not the question that was just asked. But you're saying that you want it to be inclusive of the 99%, but I don't think that's possible when you have a power position as such. You know, you're talking about reforming capitalism, but I think that as a whole, many of us that are involved in this movement don't like capitalism or don't feel that, you know, it supports anything but another oligarchy. And so I have to say that respectfully, I think you're missing the point.
Well, the word capitalism, I think, is not the right way to think about it. The question is, can people work productively for their communities and make a living and not necessarily exploit anybody? And that's the question. There are, real rules that have been given in lots of communities for anti-exploitation, for giving people fair salaries, for sharing profits, etc. The question is, how do you move in that direction, and what exactly would you do to move in that direction? I think any move in that direction is positive, and I think it's that the Occupy movement, not necessarily those who are in the encampments, the people supporting him, who are largely people who work in businesses, who are trying to do something productive with their lives and help their communities,
okay,
and
actually,
who are part of that, those people should
be. We have 5 minutes left, and we want to try to get to some other questions, so if we could.
So make your questions short and your answers short, and I don't know that we'll get to the end.
Okay, so before coming here, I looked up the Nuremberg trials on Wikipedia, and the indictments were for participation in a conspiracy for a crime against peace, planning, initiating, and waging wars of aggression, and other crimes against peace, war crimes, which includes violations of international humanitarian law, including the ill-treatment or deportation of civilian residents of an occupied territory, and crimes against humanity that constitute a serious attack on human dignity, including political prosecution.
What's your question?
So I'm curious, as far as the future of the Occupy movement and what we're going to focus on as we move forward, what are some ways, and I'm specifically asking Diana, Iris, and Nadim, what are some ways that you think that we can incorporate this dialogue into a sort of broader discourse with the American public to let them know that we actually think that what's happening now is very serious, and we are living in 1984.
There are 3 minutes total left. You get to choose whether you take it to answer or let another question happen.
2 minutes.
I could take the question.
Nadim, why don't you answer?
You know, on this issue, I take the Chomskyan attitude. Chomsky, since his early years, has always defended anarchism. This is a man I think you all know. And his approach was education. You don't have to appeal to a faulty public opinion in order to change something. You educate and reconstruct, redefine the term. And one could take it as an example, any kind of example. If the public opinion is racist, you don't appeal to the public opinion to change that opinion. You inform and you educate and you fight for what you stand. And as such, one does what the Chomsky does, sticks by his position, consistent, and as much as he can, educate people and decolonize their mind.
Okay. Do we have time for another question?
Yes.
I just want to preempt this question with something from a quick fact.
Make it quick.
And that is that the CBO tells us that in the past 30 years that income, the top 1% of earners has increased 275%. My question is that where was Occupy in the past 30 years and what structural changes can we expect to see so that in the next 30 years the top 1% of earners don't see their incomes rise by another 275% and that the bottom 99% of earners can see a share of their share of national GDP actually rise as opposed to decrease as we've seen in the past 30 years.
Do you have a specific person who you'd like to answer that question?
Look, but think of elections, because that's where power resides. Think of elections, because that's where power resides. And if you don't, the right wing will think of elections, because they've been doing it. It's a very dangerous time right now. And if that is not turned around, we're in big trouble.
Power resides in the money. There are several state initiatives that would shift wealth from wealthy people to the school districts, and you should consider working on them.
Okay. So that is it. And again, many of the panelists will be around after the program is over, when you guys are in your breakout sessions. And yes. No, we will. So before we go, though, we have there is a question that we always ask at the end of every Inforum program. And so we'll just start down the row. We'll start with Diana and go all the way down to Professor Lakoff. The question is, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? Diana.
Really quick, get involved in the Occupy movement. Like, short and simple.
Awesome. Mayor Kwan.
I've worked on a lot of movements over the years. What I'm focused on right now is to try to break the cycle of violence and poverty in my city. So I'm focusing on 60 seconds.
You can do it.
Okay. I'm focusing on 100 blocks where most of the murders, where most of the dropouts, et cetera, are happening. So we're putting in the most resources, whether it's jobs, whether it's mentors, whether it's the Christmas toy drive, whether it's police officers walking kids to school. We are organizing people in the neighborhoods to get more involved in the community councils. That's democracy at the bottom in our city, and letting them have more control over decisions on city resources in their neighborhoods.
Okay. Next, Nadim.
Honestly, I would say the most important thing you need to do is dismantle all forms of illegitimate authority. Authority based on violence, authority based on unjustified premises, and to do it out of love, not out of revenge, or not out of seeking to hurt people.
I think some of the bases have already been covered, so I'm just going to say what I think would change the world is if many of you, if not all of you, go to the Oscar Grant Plaza tonight or sometime this week and bring warm clothing and food. And coffee.
I want to switch a little bit. The one of the things that linguists learn is that every language in the world has in its grammar the ability to talk about direct causation and no language has in its grammar the ability to talk about systemic causation. Yet all of ecology is systemic, and all of the economic system is systemic. It goes across categories. And systems have certain properties. They're homeostatic, self-correcting. They have positive and negative feedback. They have multiple causes. They have causes at a distance. They cross categorization and so on. We need to understand how systems work. We need to understand it for the sake of understanding the history, the fate of our planet and the fate of our economy, and also the fate of our politics, because that is also a system.
Okay, thank you very much. Everyone, please give our panelists all a big round of applause for being here. And now this meeting of Inforum at the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.